In a moment, I'm going to invite you to listen to the words of Richard Feynman. Richard Feynman died in 1988, but he remains one of the greatest physicists in history. He was incredibly talented as a physicist, but he also had an infectious love for life and a knack for entertaining. He didn't believe in God in any conventional sense, but he celebrated the mystery of the universe. I could have brought you a reading, and I could have read his words, but I think it's so much better to see the person speaking.
But, friend, with an artist, and sometimes take a view, which I don't agree with very well, you'll hold up a flower and say, look how beautiful it is, and I agree, I think. And he says, see, as I as an artist can see how beautiful this is, but you as a scientist, oh, take this all apart, and it becomes dull thing, and I think that he's kind of nutty. First of all, the beauty that he sees is available to other people and to me too, I believe, although I may not be quite as refined as aesthetically as he is, that I can appreciate the beauty of the flower. At the same time, I see much more about the flower than he sees. I could imagine the cells in it, the complicated actions inside, which also have a beauty. I mean, it's not just beauty at this dimension of 1 centimeter, there's also beauty at the smaller dimensions. The inner structure, also the processes, the fact that the colors and the flower evolved in order to attract insects to pollinate it is interesting. It means that insects can see the color. It adds a question. Does this aesthetic sense also exist in the lower forms? Why is it aesthetic? All kinds of interesting questions, which the science knowledge only adds to the excitement, the mystery, and the awe of a flower. It only adds. I don't understand how it subtracts. If you expected science to give all the answers to the wonderful questions about what we are, where we're going, what the meaning of the universe is, and so on, that I think you could easily become disillusioned and then look for some mystic answers to these problems. How a scientist can take a mystic answer, I don't know, because the whole spirit is still under. Well, never mind that. I don't understand that. But anyhow, if you think of it, though, by the way, I think of what we're doing is we're exploring, we're trying to find out as much as we can about the world. People say to me, are you looking for the ultimate laws of physics? No, I'm not. I'm just looking to find out more about the world. And if it turns out there is a simple ultimate law that explains everything, so be it. That would be very nice and scary. If it turns out it's like an onion with millions of layers and we're just sick and tired of looking at the layers, then that's the way it is. But whatever way it comes out, its nature is there and she's going to come out the way she is. And therefore, when we go to investigate it, we shouldn't pre-decide what it is we're trying to do except to find out more about it. You see, one thing is I can live with doubt and uncertainty and not knowing. I think it's much more interesting to live not knowing than to have answers which might be wrong. I have approximate answers and possible beliefs and different degrees of certainty about different things, but I'm not absolutely sure of anything, and of many things I don't know anything about. But I don't have to know an answer. I don't feel frightened by not knowing things, by being lost in a mysterious universe without having any purpose, which is the way it really is, as far as I can tell, possibly. It doesn't frighten me. And so altogether, I can't believe the special stories that have been made up about our relationship to the universe at large, because they seem to be too simple, too connected, too local, too provincial. The earth, he came to the earth. One of the aspects of God came to the earth, mind you. And look at what's out there. How can it isn't in proportion. Anyway, it's no use arguing. I can't argue. I'm just trying to tell you. With the scientific view, well, my father's view, that we should look to see what's true and what maybe may not be true. Once you start doubting, which I think to me is a very fundamental part of my soul, is to doubt. To ask. When you doubt and ask, it gets a little harder to believe.
I hope you enjoy hearing Richard Feynman in person. a number of really entertaining books, Marriage and Feynman. We probably have one in our library, I bet. So Richard Feynman died in 1988. That was, I think, 1983. He had an infectious sense of humor. It was based on an irreverent, logical, scientific approach. And he took that towards everything. He died after a long battle with cancer. And his last words as he lay in the hospital bed were, "I would hate to die twice. It's so boring." In that video, Feynman speaks of beauty from the perspective of a curious scientist. And surely you have to consider that beauty looks different from different perspectives. I've told you many times how much I love my job. As your minister, I get to prepare for this sermon. I had the privilege to devote time reflecting on the nature of beauty. And what could be more rewarding than that? Unfortunately, there just wasn't enough time to do all the reflecting that I wanted to do. But one of the things that I quickly realized is how beautiful we all are. This congregation is made up of beautiful people. And the more I spend time with you in services, in committees, as individuals, the more I come to appreciate your beauty. And the amazing and wonderful fact is that you're not unique as a congregation. Human beings are just beautiful creatures on the whole. Well, there are exceptions for sure, but the exceptions prove the rule. A healthy child raised in a loving environment will almost always become a beautiful human being. Beauty nurtures love, and love nurtures beauty. Overall, we human beings are lovely creatures. Such potential we have. Potential for compassion. Such poignancy in our lives. We know how our lives will end. We know we're not getting out of this alive. And there's poignancy as we age from childhood to old age with that knowledge. So what is beauty? Let's start there. And I won't ask Norm to look it up. I looked it up last night. And I found a dictionary definition that I rather liked. It said, "Beauty is that quality present in a thing or a person that gives intense pleasure or deep satisfaction to the mind, whether arising from sensory manifestations like shape and color and sound, or meaningful design or patterns, or something else, such as personality, in which high spiritual qualities are manifest." It's easy to dismiss beauty as something frivolous, something to appreciate or pursue once the real work of life is done. But what if beauty is something more? Something life-giving, something life-sustaining, something life-repairing. What if beauty is nature's way of protecting itself, of making us fall in love again, that we might care for one another and for this earth? What if beauty holds the power to pull us back from the brink, to remind us that we are inextricably connected to each other and to the universe? What if beauty can heal, inspire, and transform? Is it frivolous then? The definition I used would refute the oft-repeated statement that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. The definition says beauty is a quality in a person or a thing that provides intense pleasure or deep satisfaction. It suggests that beauty is a real thing, that it exists in the world outside the observer, and it exists for a reason. Beauty triggers in us pleasure, and that pleasure prompts us to love and to protect, and in some cases to create that which we find beautiful. The designer Louis Schwarzberg suggests that beauty and seduction are nature's way of protecting itself. After all, he says, we protect what we fall in love with. Beauty is a quality that exists outside the beholder. That doesn't mean that beauty exists independent of the beholder. When we think of beauty, we might easily think of the beauty of flowers, and that's why Richard Feynman used that example. Flowers exist for one reason. They exist to attract creatures who will move pollen from one flower to another, ensuring the sexual reproduction of the plant bearing the flower. Flowers and pollinators evolve together. It's interesting that the oldest fossil for a flowering plant is 125 million years old. That might seem like a long time, but it isn't really. When we go to Blue Beach, we'll be looking at rocks that were formed when creatures were walking the Earth 350 million years ago, more than twice as old. So in fact, for most of the time of the dinosaurs, for example, most of the time dinosaurs roamed the Earth, there were no flowers. Flowers develop special features to attract and make use of pollinators, such that things like sweet nectar and the placement of the stamen and the pistil to maximize pollen transfer. The pollinators, in turn, develop special adaptations to get access to the nectar. Story that illustrates that, in 1862, Charles Darwin visited Madagascar, where he saw an incredible orchid. And that orchid had its nectar at the base of a long tube that was 10 inches long. He looked at the flower and he postulated the existence of a moth with a tongue that was 10 inches long, based on his understanding of evolution. 51 years later, the moth was found, exactly as predicted. But the question that interests me this morning is, why is the flower beautiful? I can see why it's functional, but why is it beautiful? In the video we just watched, Richard Feynman, the skeptical scientist, tells us that the beauty of the flower may suggest that insects and other pollinators have an aesthetic sense. That the bee, for example, sees beauty in the flower and is attracted to that beauty. Another indication that beauty is ubiquitous is the ubiquitous force in the universe. Well, if Louis Schwarzberg was correct, and if we're driven to love and protect that which is beautiful, then it may just be that beauty is an aspect of the natural world with the potential to save the natural world from the ravenous greed of the human species. We're destroying this beautiful natural planet and its habitats and its creatures at a pace that has never been seen in the past. Not even during times of great natural cataclysm, like the great extinctions that brought about the asteroid impacts or the massive volcanic eruptions. Intellectually, we understand the concept of the interdependent web of life. And yet the intellectual argument, the scientific logic, does not have the power, the powerful pull on our psyche that a picture of a rainforest or a pod of whales swimming free in the ocean or polar bears on ice floes can evoke. It has long been a concern of environmentalists that it's only the baby seals and the large mammals with big brown eyes that galvanize human beings into taking action to preserve species, while less beautiful creatures go to extinction without attracting any outcry. There can be no doubt that beauty in this context can play an important role in saving our planet from its most successful species. That would be us. I'm planning a service at the end of the month, jointly with the Ecology Action Center, on efforts to restore the Sawmill River in Dartmouth. That river once flowed freely through the city of Dartmouth, and was subsequently dug up and buried in a big pipe underground, essentially turning a river into a sewer. What could be more beautiful than a river in its natural state, flowing through a forest or a mountain valley, supporting an abundance of plants and animals? The instinct to respond to such beauty may be our best hope in our efforts to restore our ecosystem. The problem may be that nature has endowed this planet with so much that is achingly beautiful. We live in the Garden of Eden. We come to believe that individual rivers and individual species and individual habitats can be sacrificed. There's always more out there that we can appreciate. A year ago, I received an email with a video attachment, and it was an appeal to preserve the Bedford Reef in Bedford. And I believe that's still an ongoing issue. The people who were trying to rally support to preserve this little bit of natural habitat in the Bedford Basin attached this video that showed ospreys flying through the air and wading birds in the shallows and fish swimming and spawning. And it was a gorgeous video. And it was a beautiful little piece of earth. The appeal to save this natural habitat was based on the beauty of that natural habitat. I wondered to myself if anything could be done, or if anything would change, if before we destroyed a habitat, before we desecrated a habitat for industrial or residential development. And I know this is necessary. I know I live in a house that once was in the middle of a forest, that was a beautiful natural habitat. It was sacrificed, and I'm the beneficiary. So I know that process has to take place. But I wonder if there'd be a change in attitude or a change in process if our leaders, before we made the decision to desecrate such a space, had to go to that space and participate in a spiritual ceremony that would acknowledge the taking of that natural habitat for human use. I was thinking at the time of how our First Nations peoples give thanks and acknowledge the sacrifice made by an animal when it is killed for the benefit of the tribe. And with this ethos, no animal is killed or no plant is destroyed without real need and without real forethought. The appeal of beauty is an appeal closely tied to love. And in universalist theology, love and God are synonymous. Reverend Galen Gingrich has written, "Faith is a commitment to live as if certain things are true and thereby to help make them so." Faith is a commitment to live as if certain things are true and thereby to help make it so. Faith is a commitment to live as if life is a wondrous mystery, as if life is good, as if life is divine, as if we are responsible for the well-being of those around us. Faith is a leap of moral imagination that connects the world as it is to the world as it might become. What if we began to live our lives as if love was God? As if beauty was nature's way of protecting herself, by calling forth our love for this precious planet and the species we share it with. I'd like another quote here from Peter Morales. Peter is the president of the Unitarian Universalist Association of the United States. He wrote, "Every religious tradition on which we draw has a reverence for life, and we're part of that intricate web of life. Every tradition on which we draw teaches that the ultimate expression of our spirituality is in our action. Deep spirituality leads to action in the world. Deep reverence for life. Love of nature's beauty. And the sense of intimate connection with the cosmos leads inevitably to a commitment to work for environment and for social justice." There are other aspects of beauty that can give meaning to our lives. Beauty is a quality in things that gives intense pleasure or deep satisfaction. Most of you know that in another life, I was an engineer. And there is a whole other dimension to beauty. It's the concept of efficiency and elegance of design. A machine can certainly be beautiful, even a very utilitarian machine, a coffee pot, can be beautiful. It's beautiful when its form and its function are in perfect harmony. This connects to an underlying truth about the universe. It is especially striking and remarkable that in fundamental physics, a beautiful or elegant theory is more likely to be correct than an inelegant theory. I watched Murray Gell-Mann last night talking about this and saying that at one point in his career, he advanced a theory, published the theory, even though 7 different experiments contradicted the theory he was proposing. But he said the theory was just too beautiful. And the theory turned out to be correct, and the experiments turned out to be wrong. In this sphere, beauty and elegance equates to simplicity. The more beautiful a mathematical theory is the one that, with fewer terms and fewer variables. And science for the past 300 years has progressed because we are drawn to more beautiful and elegant formulas. Suppose for a moment that each new scientific discovery required a more complex and elaborate mathematical formulation. And to a layperson, it may seem like that's the case. It isn't. The truth is that as we look deeper and deeper and discover more and more, we find connections between things that we never thought were connected. We find underlying simplicity. But if it wasn't that way, if everything you study got more and more complex, there would be no joy in that. It would just become a chore, trying to add another term, trying to make an equation that's ever longer. And the knowledge gained in one field of science would be essentially useless in another. If we didn't have this underlying beauty as we studied atomic physics and studied chemistry, the two would diverge and people would become experts in either but couldn't talk to each other. Instead, we find that as people study these two things, there's an underlying law that links both of them. If that was the case, without this underlying simplicity, our scientific and technological process would come to a rapid end. Somehow, the universe itself is very simple, very elegant, very beautiful, very open to comprehension by the brains of a naked ape that only recently evolved from its fellow apes. So in conclusion, what are we to make of beauty? Beauty is all around us if we look for it. From the face of a child to the face of a great-great-grandparent. From the structure of one cell in our bodies to the vast swirling mass of stars in the Milky Way. Beauty and love are intertwined, part of the definition of God. Beauty is a powerful active force for good in the universe. It spawns love, and love spawns protection of that worthy of love, and that in return spawns evolution. Beauty is an underlying principle of the universe that makes its comprehensibility to human brains and makes it possible for all of the technological advances that have begun to transform our species and that will someday take us to the stars. The message here is that beauty is anything but trivial or frivolous. Beauty is a reality, a type of force in the universe that calls us into relationship and that provides guideposts on our quest for survival. Not only survival, but our quest to flourish and to achieve our potential in the universe. May it be so. And amen.